The presidential election week has ended. Some races are still up in the air and votes are still being counted, but Joe Biden has been announced the president-elect.
I pledge to be a president who seeks not to divide, but unify. Who doesn't see red states and blue states, only sees the United States. And work with all my heart, with the confidence of the whole people, to win the confidence of all of you. And for that is what America, I believe, is about.
Biden ran on the message of overcoming division. Will this be possible?
I just don't understand. It's beyond me how he was able to get more people to vote. It really made me think, what is it that in this country we're like this? And it makes me sad.
Donald Trump lost the bid for a second term, but he did make gains in votes, coming in with more support than during his 2016 run for the presidency. At this time, the USA appears to be a country of two minds. How is this happening?
We're in deep crises right now, right? We're in obvious climate crisis with the fires. We're in deep economic crisis, the worst since the Great Depression. We're in a healthcare crisis. And we've got two parties controlling the political direction of this country and their allied media that refuse to talk about anything but tribal identification and conflict without proposing a solution to any of it.
The Green Party offers an alternative vision and approach to our future and overcoming division. Steve Greenfield, the Green Party candidate from New York for the U.S. House of Representatives, explains. And we hear from others around the country asking, why are we so divided and can this be overcome? From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica Radio and its affiliate stations across the country. I'm your host for this hour, Ursula Rudenberg. During the election, the vote count was long and arduous. For 4 days and nights, ballot officials spent hours tallying record numbers of ballots. Protests erupted both for and against making sure every ballot was being counted. Those who carried out the job did their best to make sure the process was transparent and thorough. Lise King from WOMR Radio in Provincetown, Massachusetts, has followed the vote count around the country.
First of all, I've been very impressed with the states that they've been responding to reporters' questions. When the Secretary of State comes up from Nevada or Arizona or the representative in charge of counting the ballots, when they are on camera and they're answering reporters' questions, they've been absolutely adamant about the fact that this is a transparent process. Every vote's being counted. This is how we do it. You know, we have both Republican and Democratic observers. Right. Some of our folks are wearing body cameras and it's being projected to another room. I mean, they're like, there are cameras. Anybody can tune in and watch what's going on to look for any potential irregularities. They've been absolutely strong in their vocalization about there is no fraud going on here. We're all just doing our job and we're following the policy that's been set by the state legislature. We don't make policy. We're administrators. We're doing the job we were set out to do. I think it's been really impressive. The local folks in charge have been very strong in their statements. Even the Republican governor states have been very also vocal about shoring up their confidence in the process that's happening, even though the majority of the vote counting that's going on is from their largely Democratic areas around their major cities. I really have to give kudos to those Republican governors who have been adamant about the fact that they support the process that's happening and they trust the people on the ground. And one of the pundits was pointing out, well, that's because these guys are going to be up for re-election. So this is where the democratic process really does work. There is a pressure to respond to your constituents and do what the voters want, right? That's our democracy at work. But at the same time, we also know that it looks like it's going to go exactly the way this was mapped out. And Trump has already telegraphed very clearly that he doesn't plan to go quietly into that good night. So it just depends on how difficult of an exit Trump wants to make. And so we're just going to have to find out to what degree the states will step up. Earmarks of a healthy democracy or democracy at all and especially ours, has been the peaceful transfer of power. So then the question becomes, at what cost will the transfer of power happen?
On Saturday, November 7th, the presidential race was called and ended. In a historic turnout, the 2020 race was called for Joe Biden, who garnered a record number of the popular vote, which reached almost 75 million. On Saturday night, President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris took the stage to make their acceptance speeches at a parking lot rally in Wilmington, Delaware.
We stand at an inflection point. We have an opportunity to defeat despair, to build a nation of prosperity and purpose. We can do it. I know we can. I've long talked about the battle for the soul of America. We must restore the soul of America. Our nation is shaped by the constant battle between our better angels and our darkest impulses. And what presidents say in this battle matters. It's time for our better angels to prevail. Tonight, the whole world is watching America. And I believe at our best, America is a beacon for the globe. We will not lead. We will lead not only by the example of our power, but by the power of our example.
Biden, addressing a deeply divided nation, invoked the spirit of compromise and reconciliation, asking Americans to join him in a show of unity.
I said at the outset, I wanted to represent this campaign to represent and look like America. We've done that. Now that's what I want the administration to look like and act like. For all those of you who voted for President Trump, I understand the disappointment tonight. I've lost a couple times myself, but now let's give each other a chance. It's time to put away the harsh rhetoric, lower the temperature, see each other again, listen to each other again. And to make progress, we have to stop treating our opponents as our enemies. They are not our enemies, they are Americans. They're Americans. The Bible tells us to everything there is a season, a time to build, a time to reap and a time to sow, and a time to heal. This is the time to heal in America.
Joe Biden's campaign message had been one of overcoming division. His promise has been to unify instead of divide the country. Will he be able to succeed? And if so, how? Today on COVID Race and Democracy, Pacifica Network members reflect on this question of a country divided. Community Radio's mission is to build community and to bring people together through communication. Today we hear firsthand from many who work in this field, who explore on a daily basis what is the experience of being a nation divided. How does this happen in different communities, and where are the possibilities for coming together to overcome division? Alicia Sanchez, board president of bilingual KBBF Radio in Santa Rosa, California, Lise King from WOMR Radio in Provincetown, Massachusetts, and Joseph Orozco, lead producer of KIDE Hoopa Tribal Radio in Hoopa, California, recently discussed how division is occurring as well as how it is affecting Americans at this time. Alicia began by describing her experience from the perspective of a Hispanic American.
As a person of color, it was very upsetting. It makes me realize that the United States is based on racism, and it makes me sad. But we've been through all of this before, all of us, but especially people of color. And so it makes me determined, yeah, as we always keep saying, the struggle continues. And even among ourselves, people of color, sometimes we blame ourselves. I see that, you know, even among ourselves, we say, oh, look, the Latinos are not going out to vote and everything. But yes, we are. We got to change the narrative. I think we people of color move the election, you know. And also we have to just always keep going back to that thing of not fighting among ourselves, not blaming ourselves, but to look at who is causing all of this. We have to keep reminding ourselves of that. We're all on the same boat and we got to be aware of that. Because it's so easy to kind of want to blame each other. You know what I mean? We're such a diverse group of people, Latinos. And so here we go in one more battle, and that's all there's to it.
Lise King.
One of the things I think is important to point out when you were talking about that this is a racial divide, I think it's actually race is where it shows up and we can label it easily, but this is about, it's a privilege divide, even more than that. The Tea Party came out of the recognition that there was a huge demographic shift going on in the country. It was no longer going to be a majority white country. Now, white is a cover also, though, for basically power. And power is about economic power as well. So this is, yes, about race, but race is an easy way to frame it because it's on the outside and we can see it. And you can see whether someone's black or white or Hispanic or, but you can't see what they have in their bank account necessarily, right? So it becomes the replacement for that. So, for example, like here in Provincetown, you think it's deep blue, and yet we have a very robust Jamaican community, folks who come here on the H-2B visas to work in the restaurants, and they also serve as laborers in the community. And there is a prominent black gentleman who's moved to town. He's on the board of the Provincetown Theater. He's very active in town government. And yet he often is treated when he goes around like he's the help. Like he'll show up at things and someone will assume that he's like a worker, right? And a deep blue, very liberal bastion. What that means is that race has become the visual expression of privilege or lack thereof in this country, right? And so when you're talking about what's happening with the demographic shifts in our country, there are two things that politicians care about. That's money and votes. And so if you're looking at people of color and you're saying, I want to hold on to my privilege as a white person, my privilege in this country, then the one place where you can be afraid, because you know maybe people of color you don't think have a lot of money, but they have a lot of votes. So the more that the demographic shifts happen, the more people of color assumed, you know, demographically non-white folks have power in this country because votes do count and they do matter. We're seeing this happening right now in the vote counting as we speak. So if there's anything that I would want to add, maybe to just sort of broaden the picture about race as a stand-in, and that what we're really talking about is privilege and power.
Joseph Orozco.
I have my own thoughts of privilege and power. Privilege is a mindset, and it is the basis of the power. Privilege, because we talk about white privilege, and that's just the element that, because, well, there's so many, and they have this economic power, which is the racism. And you can't be racist until you have control of the economics. So a Native person speaking out against white people is not speaking from racism. He's speaking from injustice. Is speaking from a feeling of being trodden down and complaining. Don't rock the boat. I only found that people who say don't rock the boat are the people in the boat. But that's the power of the economics. If somebody, regardless of how much money they have in their pocket, does their people that they identify have the power of the economy as a group of people? Look at Warren Buffett. He owns the dams. The four dams that we're trying to remove from the Klamath River, he owns those. That's power. That's economic power. David Bernhardt, who is the Secretary of the Department of the Interior, he was the lobbyist for the Westlands Water District, who Trump has united with to get the water from Northern California to the Central Valley to the Republican-owned farms that are just sucking up our water, and they're threatening Shasta, raising Shasta Dam, but that will start flooding more of the Wintu-Winnemem traditional homelands. That's racism. That's the power. You can't have power unless you have control of the economy. You could have privilege, and that's a state of mind. That is what made America great again, and that's what Trump is trying to do. I say make America Native again. And that you'll have a completely different world.
One of the big stories of the 2020 election has been in the state of Georgia. According to the New York Times, Trump won Georgia in 2016 by 5.1%. At the time of this production, with 98% of districts reporting, Biden appears to have squeaked out a victory in Georgia by 0.21%. Stacey Abrams and organizers on the ground have received much credit for mobilizing Democratic voters. One member of an organization called Black Voters Matter remembers an incident while waiting at the polls. Heather Gray, civil and human rights activist and journalist and radio producer at WRFG in Atlanta, Georgia, reports.
All right, Demetrius, let's get back to what happened this week. So you were assisting voters as a part of Black Voters Matter. What, you had water, food? What did you have?
You know, I want to set the context for this. As I said before, we were, as a group, and not exclusively Black Voters Matter, but we had actually formed a coalition of quite a few groups here locally in Albany. We also had some church groups, John Lewis, Get Out the Vote campaign, Working Families in 9 to 5 Georgia. So we had a various groups that had come together to offer support and help to the elections office to make sure we had a fair, safe election in November. Of course, you know how devastating COVID was for Albany. So we had one of the highest infection rates in the world per capita. And we just thought it was very imperative that we do what we needed to do to make sure that these elections were safe. We kind of had a debacle in the primary, and that was kind of concerning for us because we had asked the elections office as early as May and some of our county officials to make absentee ballot drop boxes available and volunteer help, stuff like having an organization adopt a poll, because one of the things here that happened here, our poll workers are usually folks who are up in age, and because of the coronavirus, they were very scared to come back out and work. So they had none of the same poll workers by the time primary election rolled around. And what actually happened is they had to wind up closing a lot of polls. So people were on election day, they didn't get the word out. And of course, some people just went home. Now, those polls that had been consolidated, you know, they had long lines. We were in the midst of COVID. There were no masks. There was, again, hardly any staff to kind of manage that. So it was a very disheartening and, like I said, a kind of a debacle. So in that context, we came together to say, OK, we're going to offer help. We're going to offer whatever we can to have this safe election. So we requested a meeting with the election supervisor and the county administrator. And that was kind of under maybe a cloud of, I don't want to say a distrust, but just some turbulence, because the election supervisor has not always been cooperative when people have come to her. So, but we were, again, from the beginning rebuffed and said, okay, you need to go to the elections board and talk to them. We went to the elections board and actually wound up giving them a pretty good playbook in terms of how they could have this safe election. We developed some requests and some strategies that we wanted to help them implement. But again, we were rebuffed. We were turned down. At one point, there were some complaints about, okay, we don't have the funding for these drop boxes and it's going to cost too much money. And we found through some connections with Stacey Abrams' group Fair Fight, we were able to find $300,000, which is a lot of money for an election. And that's what kind of set the stage for this. So first day of early voting, I got a phone call from some of my constituents and that were in line in the Georgia heat, you know, saying they had been there for hours, had gotten there early, and it was still very chaotic, not put together well. They had no refuge from the shade. They had no water or chairs for people who were standing in a line that stretched for what was essentially 2 blocks. They went down the block and then turned the corner at the block and went further down the adjacent block. And it was just a mess. So I called Amna and Kiana, and it was just kind of an ad hoc thing. But, you know, eventually we got volunteers down there and got a tent. We got people to come out, and we started handing out water and snacks to the folks who were in line. Amna went out to Target and purchased some chairs, and we started passing out folding chairs the folks who were in line, and they were really just thankful for the help. And that's how this all started out. This was not planned. We actually had planned to be in the community trying to push people to go vote and not be down there trying to just kind of shore up what the elections officials had basically failed to do, which was to provide a safe and comfortable election. So, like I said, it wasn't anything that we planned to do. We just parked the van down there as kind of a makeshift operation center. People kept bringing by water, ice, got some chests, ice chests, and we were just helping out.
So there's this white woman who, while you all were assisting the voters, and did she come up to you, Demetrius? Was she talking with other folks as well? How did that work?
Well, she was in line as a voter.
Okay.
And at the moment, we just thought she was another voter, but some of us did have some connection to her on social media. But what it was, again, we were there just as, you know, volunteers. At that time, the line, that long line that I was telling you about, it had actually moved into the shade that was closest to the building.
Right.
People were just trying to escape the heat or whatever. So we moved our operation up. We moved our van, our tent, our water, snacks up to where the line was, which did cross the 150-foot mark for quote-unquote campaigns. That is the law in Georgia, that campaigns can't be within 150 feet of a polling place. So we moved over to where the line was. And you know, at that time, it had kind of become a little festive mood. We were playing music and whatnot. And as I walked past the voting line, I hear somebody say, "Commissioner Young, Commissioner Young." So I went over and she was like, you know, "What's that van about?" And I said, "What do you mean, ma'am?" Well, if we were out here saying white vote matter, we were playing redneck music, then you'd have a problem with it. I was like, "Well, not necessarily, ma'am, but if you want to do that, that's at your right. We're not doing anything illegal or wrong." "Well, yes, you are. You all are telling people how to vote and influencing the election." I was like, "Ma'am, no, we're passing out water. We're passing out snack. We're not campaigning. We're not doing any of that." And she was like, "You have campaign material. I see them passing it out." I said, "No, ma'am, those are sample ballots that people can look at while they're standing in line for hours. Would you like one?" "No, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to look at it, you know." And she started telling us, of course, how, again, and I know, and that's why we're so, I guess that's why we're kind of sensitive. Well, we know that Black Lives Matter is a movement, and we are essentially a part of that movement, just as many groups were part of the civil rights movement. But they wanted to conflate Black Voters Matter with Black Lives Matter. And at that time, all of us, when some of us had on the T-shirts. So the T-shirts, I think, are what triggered her. The van, our van is wrapped in the colors of Black liberation and has
what colors?
Red, green, and black.
Red, green, and black. And the T-shirts you were wearing had what on them?
Right. T-shirts are black T-shirts and had the black fist on it. You know, the raised black fist.
Okay, good. Okay.
And she began to get irritated and agitated about T-shirts and, you know, kind of saying we were getting in people's faces and that kind of thing. And she began to be more and more belligerent in our conversation and began to use profanity. And I was like, I placed my hand on her shoulder to try to calm her a bit, because people had at that time started looking and was like wondering what was going on. I was just asking her to be civil. And she recoiled and she was like, "Don't touch me. Don't touch me."
Was she talking loud?
Very loud. My folks at the tent had actually gotten up to kind of see what was going on. But I quickly ended the conversation and I went over to them and I said, don't engage with her. I said, "She's trying to start something." So at that point, I had a meeting to go to and I left. While I was in my meeting, I started getting calls that this woman has started acting crazy and she's pulled a gun. And I got a call from Amna, and Amna was like, "Should we call the police?" And I was like, "Yeah, call the police, because she's not supposed to have a gun at a polling precinct first of all, and then she's being threatening." So that was the situation at that particular time. And it was really upsetting for the volunteers, because probably 98, 99% of the people were very positive and thanking us, even if they didn't necessarily like what they perceived to be political viewpoint. They were saying, thank you for doing what you're doing. But this woman just took it in another space.
Pacifica Network Manager Stephanie Schubert asked Heather Gray to give her impressions of the nature of division in the South from her perspective as a longtime white civil rights activist.
Heather Gray, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
As a longtime civil rights activist, what are your thoughts upon hearing that Joe Biden is the new president-elect?
Oh, I'm relieved. I must say that I have been very concerned about the divisiveness from Donald Trump. Actually, he's led to a lot of questions about empowering certain people in the United States. So I'm relieved. I think that we'll maybe have a little bit of sensibility, is the right term to use, calming things down a little bit, perhaps, in the United States. We'll see where this goes. I'm somewhat hopeful, and there won't be as much hostility that we have witnessed under Donald Trump.
How do you view the division that remains in this country?
There are just so many issues that are problematic in the United States. And one of the major ones, of course, is class issues. Now, if we look at the history of the United States, it comes from Europe. And Europe has largely been feudalistic. And it's been this kind of mentality of the elite that will then control those underneath it. Actually, this is the way the United States has evolved as well. So this is the kind of playbook that Donald Trump is using. So I'm living in Atlanta in the South. And yes, Stephanie, I've been involved in civil and human rights issues for most of my life, actually, here in the United States. But I've also lived in Australia, in Singapore, and also in the Philippines, where I've seen some similar issues, actually, as far as the control of the elite in these countries and what that means for those who are striving to make a living for themselves and so forth and change the system to make it more democratic. But getting back to the United States, I think that it's largely, again, the white working class that has been struggling in the United States for a long time. And I'm not saying that the Democrats have been absolutely wonderful in terms of assisting the white working class. But I'm hoping that under the Biden administration, we'll see more equity in the economic system, I'm thinking, and more policies that might benefit the masses of the people. That's what I'm hoping, Stephanie. I don't know. And I'm not sure how definitive Biden has been in his campaign while he's been running for the presidency as to what he will do as far as economic system is concerned. The other divisiveness, I think, has been very racial. I've not appreciated a lot of what Trump has said that's led actually to racial divisiveness, and that's problematic also. So we will not get that kind of divisiveness from a Biden administration, I will say that.
Do you think that the economic division supersedes the racial division?
They are both problematic. I don't know that one supersedes the other. You know, it's interesting. I mean, as far as Donald Trump is concerned or the economic issues are concerned, it's interesting that, you know, a lot of the commentators make reference to the Roosevelt administration, actually, during the Depression, and how Roosevelt came up with what I call a mixed economy, right, which was not actually all that beneficial for the black community, I need to say. But certainly for the white working class, it was helpful. So a mixed economy in terms of the corporate elite could basically do what they wanted, but there were policies and programs that leading through Social Security and so forth and other programs that assisted the workers during that period. That is, racial inequities have always been problematic in the United States, regardless of the party in power. And this is one of the critical issues that we absolutely need to address. So we'll see where we go with that in this next administration as well.
What are some ways that you think we could address racial inequities in this country?
One of the things that's really important that Americans are educated. Donald Trump was complaining about, you know, the New York Times having the 1619 Project, right? That really provides an excellent educational opportunity for Americans to learn something about the history of slavery and the consequences of it and so forth. he was complaining about the Zen Project. Now, Howard Zinn started this process where they have on their website and so forth all kinds of information about racial history and what happened in the past and what's happening in the contemporary world. Now, Howard Zinn was a white scholar. You know, I am in Atlanta, and Spelman College is in Atlanta, and that's where he taught for a while. He became very involved in the 60s movement work here in Atlanta. He was just a remarkable person. So he comes at his perspective not just as a historian and a civil rights leader, but as a white person who was exposed to all this as well. I appreciated that about Howard Zinn, because he spoke out against a lot of the racial discrimination in America overall. So I think there are all kinds of opportunities for us to be educating the American public more in this. I think this should be put into the public schools. I think we should be having more community dialogues about this history. People need to understand this, because what happened historically in the United States had led to a lot of the divisiveness and racial problems overall. And Stephanie, I need to say, it's not just divisiveness in the United States, because this overall racist sentiment coming from a lot of leaders in the United States has also led to problems of violence and so forth in other countries. So it's led to problems in foreign policy as well. We have a lot of changes and healing that needs to be done in the United States on a huge, huge level, in my opinion.
Heather Gray, thank you for joining us on the show today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Heather Gray from WRFG Community Radio in Atlanta, Georgia. You're listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host for the hour, Ursula Rudenberg. Today's show comes in the wake of the 2020 election. We are examining a moment in time when our country remains very divided and possible ways to bridge that divide. Some speculate that lack of education and historical understanding about racism in the U.S. has created an opportunity for conservative media to galvanize new cultural shifts with right-wing ideology. Changes in voting patterns are occurring in the Midwestern states where white voters are in the majority. In Iowa, this has created opportunity for the GOP. Although President Trump won rural Iowa by 9 points in 2016, many still thought that Iowa was a toss-up in the 2020 presidential race. But the president prevailed, easily winning Iowa's 6 electoral votes. Many Democrats were also hopeful for regaining seats in what was a Republican-dominated legislature, and hopes were especially high for sending a Democrat, Teresa Greenfield, to the U.S. Senate to replace Republican Joni Ernst. Polls showed Greenfield was leading in Iowa, so election night was a deep disappointment to Democrats, with Ernst winning with 51.8% of the votes, and the Iowa State House remaining under GOP control, with 97 of the state's counties now represented by a Republican in either the House or the Senate, and a Republican House majority of 59-41 in the state legislature. The day after election, reporter Dennis Hart and I, both of us at KHOY Community Radio in Ames, Iowa, spoke with a political observer, Laura Bellin. Bellin, who spoke with us from her home in Des Moines, Iowa, is author of the blog Bleeding Heartland.
Last-minute voters went for Trump in Iowa again. President Trump winning Iowa, carrying Joni Ernst on his back, also shifting everything else in Iowa.
What we've seen is that Trump clearly brought out a huge number of people in rural areas and smaller towns, working class areas. That's the president's base. And not just in Iowa, but all over. I mean, he did very well in Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, Minnesota. He clearly has a very strong fan base.
Is that a personality thing in Iowa? Do they just like Donald Trump?
If you look at the totality of the data from the last 4 or 5 elections in Iowa, we shifted dramatically to the right of the country. Trump, who got 800,000 votes in 2016, that was a very strong total, that he's now almost at 900,000 votes. And so the Democrats got absolutely destroyed. And I think Democrats really have to come to terms with what are they going to do about these white working class voters who for decades really were a part of their base and have been drifting away for a long time, and particularly in the upper Midwest and Rust Belt. I don't think anyone has the answer.
Democrats have increasingly lost white, poorly educated voters, particularly white men who support Trump overwhelmingly. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's a trend that was building before Trump, particularly in the upper Midwest. And I don't really subscribe to the economic hardship hypothesis. I think that the issue really is more about cultural touch points in a lot of smaller communities. Conservative talk radio is very dominant. Fox News is very dominant. And so you have people who for years, I mean, 365 days a year, they're getting a diet of conservative oriented news and commentary. And then, you know, Democratic candidates have maybe a few months or at most a year to try to make their case with an audience that's just been steeped in all kinds of messages about, you know, Democrats wanting to take your guns or some really outlandish things like that they're going to ban the Pledge of Allegiance or change the American flag or, you know, whatever kind of conspiracy theory people come up with. And often, you know, this is widely shared in people's networks. The conservative noise machine is very effective at stirring people up about gays, Black Lives Matter, getting people upset about things. And so I think that these cultural issues are very powerful. And I thought it was very discouraging to see Joni Ernst and the groups supporting Joni Ernst run a lot of TV ads and radio ads that were playing right into that white grievance message, falsely accusing Teresa Greenfield of calling all Iowa police officers racist, having sheriffs and retired state patrolmen on there saying, Teresa Greenfield insulted us and called us racist, and it was very offensive. And Joni Ernst knew exactly what she was doing. She was exploiting a sentiment among a certain group of people that feels that the white people are unfairly criticized and disadvantaged. And I mean, I've seen polls that show that white conservatives think that actually white people are more disadvantaged than Black people are. I mean, you have to just blind yourself to reality to believe that, but that is what a lot of people believe. And I think we're going to see more campaigns on those kinds of issues in Iowa because it was perceived to be very successful for Joni Ernst.
And it has found resonance. White grievance. Whites are being threatened by a variety of social forces, if you will, Antifa types and all of this.
Race baiting concerns me a lot because I think that that's a big lesson Republicans learned this year, that they can go ahead and just push that button and say, this Democrat thinks you're a racist. And some people think being accused of being racist is actually equivalent harm to suffering the effects of structural racism or even experiencing racism. So it's a perspective widely held, and it's one that Republicans are very skilled at exploiting.
What do the Democrats have to do to increase their appeal with those working class white voters?
Well, I think that's the big question, right? You know, I think it's a puzzle that people haven't really figured out. And I hear, you know, we just need new leaders. And I understand that impulse, but like, if only it were just that simple, because it's something that's happening really all over the country, and especially in the upper Midwest. We see that among white voters in smaller towns, medium-sized cities, and rural areas. It's a basket of cultural issues that are used to great effect for Republicans. And there is a change. I do think it's related partly to the media landscape that I mentioned before. It's just not the same map as when there were a lot of smaller counties where Democrats could do quite well. Joe Biden didn't flip a single Trump county.
It's tempting to think that crisis will provoke people to rethink what's best for them. And yet this pandemic here in Iowa kind of has shown the opposite.
Yeah, it is counterintuitive. You would think that if you confront people with facts that challenge their beliefs, that you might be able to change their minds, but often it just reinforces the belief. Psychological researchers have established that. But the Wisconsin counties that have the highest death rates per capita from COVID-19, actually Trump increased his vote share there, which is hard to fathom. I'm very concerned about what is going on with the pandemic in Iowa. I think our hospitals are really on the cusp of being overwhelmed. And it seems like we're going to have to change course. And yet a large segment of the population is now very ideologically invested in not adjusting their behavior, not wearing a mask, continuing to eat indoors and go to bars, and it's worrying.
And there's almost like a vote against change itself.
I remember it, that during the 2016 campaign, the Never Hillary left, who said that, well, a Trump presidency wouldn't be so bad because it would move more people toward this left change agent perspective. And there have been a lot of people energized to participate in those activist movements, but it definitely hasn't radicalized the broader population. And it, as we just saw, Trump was able to increase on his total votes from 2016. He brought out people who didn't even vote for him last time, but who now are saying, you know, this is the guy I want to support.
Given the divides in this country, does this country ever unite again, or is this a permanent state of affairs?
People are increasingly getting their news in different silos, and we don't have a shared base of facts from which we're operating. So that's a big problem. But so much can change. I mean, Michael Dukakis won Iowa. He carried 75 or 74 Iowa counties in 1988. And now we've had two elections in a row where the Republican presidential candidate carried 93 counties. So nothing is permanent. So I don't know what it's going to be like 10 or 20 or 30 years from now. But I do think that it's a puzzle that people haven't really figured out. But uniting the country in the near term is going to be very difficult.
That was Laura Bellin, political commentator and author of the blog Bleeding Heartland, speaking with Dennis Hart and me, Ursula Rudenberg, at KHOI Community Radio in Ames in the red state of Iowa. Lori Veninger in Provincetown, Massachusetts, was one Democrat who took action to connect with others around the country, despite skepticism that this could actually affect any results. She belongs to a letter-writing group, which is part of an organization called Indivisible.
This is Lise King, and we are speaking today with Lori Veninger. She is the director of Indivisible Outer Cape, and she's here to talk to us today for our show, COVID, Race, and Democracy. Hi, Lori, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're an example of the grassroots organizing that's happened all across the country. Could you tell us what the letter writing campaign was about, and where it came from, and what you guys did with it?
So the letter writing campaign came from an organization called Vote Forward, and they did all of the research into underrepresented communities across the country and got a hold of the voters list. And they provided that information to us with suggested scripts and how to do it. And then we reached out to the community and to members and said, here's an opportunity for us to reach voters who maybe don't vote frequently, or maybe voters who have been disenfranchised or purged from the rolls. Mm-hmm. Or, for instance, when Stacey Abrams came out and said that we have to overwhelm the system in order to thwart the voter suppression in Georgia, and so we wrote to voters, people wrote personal stories, why voting was important to them and why, you know, everybody should vote. And some people wrote from scripts that we would prepare. We used Stacey's own words when she said that voters need to overwhelm the system in order to thwart voter suppression, which is, I think, exactly what we actually achieved this week.
This is just such a great example of taking your angst and your frustrations or your anger and turning it into action. That's just really a perfect example of that.
So we did in total over 7,000 of those Vote Forward letters. Mm-hmm. And I lost count at 25,000 postcards.
Amazing.
Around that were written by the people of the Outer Cape, and not just written, but stamped by. So do the math, because that to me is a huge amount of money. Apparently, a lot of people have these envelopes in their house where they put all the odd stamps that don't equal enough to mail a letter. So we got envelopes of like 2-cent stamps and 8 cents, like all sorts of denominations of stamps. Some of our letters had like 6 different, like very colorful, because the stamps are beautiful. They have teapots on them, or, you know, dogs or whatever. and choo-choo trains, all sorts of, and there was like 6 or 8 stamps that would span the top of the envelope. I'm like, this has got to get somebody's attention just because of that. A lot of people thought it was really stupid, right? That there's no evidence that it makes a difference or anything. But I think that when you get a handwritten letter in the mail, it you at least stop for a second and say, what the heck is this? Because nobody does it anymore. So I think it just for that reason, you have to open it. Right.
Here on the very tip of Cape Cod, we are the bluest of the blue. So sometimes folks are like, what are you activating for? You know, like we're kind of a pretty homogenous, deep blue liberal group out here.
We don't yet have many diverse people in the indivisible groups. We're mostly white older ladies, right, who can afford to take the time and do all of this stuff. We don't have that many younger people. We don't have that many people of color. But we are reaching out to them. And over the past couple months, especially with what happened with George Floyd's murder and the Black Lives Matter movement, and now just recently with the Protect the Results campaign that we've been working with, we have started developing these hopefully long-lasting, trusting relationships. We understand that we probably don't deserve the trust of communities of color, but we're going to try our best to earn it and to stick with it.
It's important for people to recognize the sheer volume of numbers of people like yourselves out there doing the work and organizing people, and how important it has been, like little like points of light all over the country.
Exactly. So these are concrete actions that people can take that really only take a few minutes. And if everybody would do it, I think it would make such a difference. But yeah, so I think we just have to keep, like you said, reaching out to everybody in our own communities and in other communities and sharing these ideas for making our democracy fulfill its promise to everybody. And then there was the New York Times article, I think it was just a week or two ago. They interviewed this woman who was moved by one to actually go register and to vote. And so who knows, that could have been one I wrote or one somebody in my group wrote. And as far as I'm concerned, there's never any harm in trying, right? The only harm is if you shut yourself in your room and do nothing. That's where you have the harm.
So, Lori, thank you so much. So this is Lise King for WMR, WFMR on the Pacifica Affiliate Network.
Steve Greenfield was a Green Party candidate running for the House of Representatives in the state of New York. As a member of the Green Party, he offers an alternative analysis that focuses less on overcoming division and more on redefining the goals of the parties and the political debate during the campaigns. Cynthia Pooler from WCAA Community Radio in Albany, New York, reports.
I'm speaking with Steve Greenfield, who ran in the 19th District of New York State on the congressional level as a Green. And we're going to talk about why he thinks our country is so divided.
Well, we have a big problem in this country in terms of how we operate our campaigns and our politics overall. And maybe this began in the late 1990s with a business decision by Fox and MSNBC, respectively, to polarize the media and appeal to only select audiences instead of a general audience as a way of maximizing brand loyalty from their viewers. And then maybe the two major parties then continued that process. But we tend to run our elections on the basis of how we think of ourselves as people, as opposed to what actually needs to be done to keep this country operating effectively and efficiently and resolving in an expeditious manner any of the crises that come up along the way that we need to face. You know, just like you would, you know, if your boiler broke down in your house, you'd figure out what to do about that, right? And in this country, in politics, by and large, we don't do that anymore. We have one party running on we're the party of patriotism, and the other party is running on we're the party of empathy, right? Without either one of those parties saying that they're going to provide everyone with health care in the middle of a pandemic. Like, they're not fixing the broken boiler. Neither one. They're just reinforcing how we feel about each other as people, our respective tribes, how we identify. There are many other manifestations of it. You know, we're the party of Jesus. We're the party of oppressed minorities. We're the party of, and yet the Democrats don't ever actually implement any policies that improve the lives of oppressed minorities. They just keep saying it, right? It's a tribal identifier. And the Republicans do the same thing. And gradually, people have learned that that's how we elect people, right? Who we think we are in the world, not what we think is going to solve the problems of this country or even just keep it running effectively. And so nobody's voting anymore on the basis of what they think to be effective civil administration. And when you looked at in our race in the 19th, which you just mentioned, you know, obviously I was running on my 10-point plan, my 10-point plan of concrete solutions for the things that we're in the middle of. I noted in one forum that the Libertarian candidate, Victoria Alexander, that although she is a Libertarian and things that she was proposing did not strike me as effective solutions, because a lot of the things we're facing right now are not market issues and therefore can't be solved with market mechanisms. But, you know, but that's the debate, right? See, that's the debate. She was proposing things that in her view would work, would actually change things and work. And I was proposing things that in my view were better systems by which things would work, by which problems would be solved. And we weren't invited to any of the debates, and we weren't afforded any coverage in the media. And so that's where we are, right? I mean, I guess solutions don't get ratings, don't sell newspapers. Only controversy and hostility and conflict sell newspapers or get clicks, you know, on the internet. And so that's where we are. It is an intractable situation, despite the fact that Joe Biden has won the single office, the presidency, right? The presidency is changing. But in the House, Republicans actually gained seats. And it's interesting to note that all the seats they gained were over your more right-wing corporate-type Democrats, your more progressive Rashida Tlaib, Alexander Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Pressley. They all won their elections, the people who they're in the solution model. And the ones that were running on tribal identity, they're the ones who lost seats. Republicans actually gained in the House. At the state legislature level, not only did Democrats not turn any state legislatures from red to blue, but at least two states went from blue to red. Everyone's still hung over from their partying over Joe Biden winning to have allowed any of this to register yet. So the gerrymandering problem is just going to get worse now that the new census is coming in. We've got actually more states controlled by Republicans than before this election. Democrats were aiming to win one office. I know Trump is a terrible person and we have to get rid of him. And since that's all they were aiming for, that's all they got. They didn't generate any policies. And so right-wing people continued to make gains all over the country because the only thing the Democrats were proposing was, we'll get rid of Trump, we'll get rid of Trump, we'll get rid of Trump. And we're in deep crises right now, right? We're in climate crisis with the fires. We're in deep economic crisis, the worst since the Great Depression. We're in a healthcare crisis. And we've got two parties controlling the political direction of this country and their allied media that refuse to talk about anything but tribal identification and conflict without proposing a solution to any of it.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We would like to thank all of the Pacifica stations and affiliates who contributed to this program. You can find this and all previous episodes on our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. This show was produced by myself, Ursula Rudenberg, and Stephanie Schubert at Pacifica Radio Network. Our executive producers are Steve Zeltzer, Polina Bezileff, and Akua Holt. Thank you for listening.